Hi, everyone. My name is Art Lewis, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Art.
Hi, Art.
And I guess Mike told you Don. Mike's over there. Yeah, Don told you I was from Van Nuys, California. That's the home of the Menendez trial and the some of the riots. We had fires there, and we're just about 2 miles from the earthquake. And actually, it's about a mile and a half closer than any lake to Lemon Grove. And because I only go to any length, and I was told that this is certainly not past any length. I'm really glad to be here, more glad than you'd imagine, and I hope I get around to some of this stuff. I never know what's going to happen when I open my mouth, and I want to first welcome the new friends we have here, the seven guys that raised their hands, and any of you others that didn't raise your hand. I only got to raise my hand once as a newcomer. I found out they did that, and I stopped going to meetings until after 30 days, because I've been immediately restored to ego. And last time I really spoke at a group. It was a very big group. It was that big Pacific group meeting up in Los Angeles, and it was terrible. It was the only, and I'd spoken there before. It was, I enjoyed sharing with a group, but I've been going through a lot of stuff, and basically did a fifth step in front of the whole group. It was really traumatic. I never cried on the podium before, and it is. But, you know, it was unpleasant for me, but afterwards I felt healed. And I think every time I've shared honestly with a group, I felt better. And that's why I'm here today. I'm glad that Peggy invited me and sent me a map. And I'm even more glad that I came. You see, because like those 3 and 9-year birthday people, several weeks back when Peggy called me, I made a decision to come here. And that didn't take effect until I actually got in my car and got myself down here to be with you. That's just like when I did my third step. You know, I made a decision that I was going to try and behave the way God wants me to behave. I didn't always do that, I have to tell you. And if you're not perfect, I think my story shows that you don't have to be perfect to stay sober. And if that's the only message you get, that's cool. And if you're new, I'm not going to teach anybody how to stay sober or get sober here. I don't know how to get sober. I know something about how to stay sober for 4,251 days, because that's the current length of my sobriety, which is about 11 and a half years, so Tom knows. But what really is significant, and what I hope you walk away with, is some hope. Hope that somebody like me, where nothing worked for them, was able to stay sober, you know, these 52 days plus. If somebody like me can do it, you could say, you know, maybe you can. And that's the whole purpose of being here. It's not to entertain you, and it's not to mystify you, and it's not to get money out of you, and it's like all these things that AA isn't. I'm not that either, man. You know, I'm just a little business consultant from up in Van Nuys is trying to live one day at a time sober. And actually, my life is really good today. I guess I better tell you that first. Because sometimes I get so wrapped up in my drinking story, I forget to tell people about what sobriety is like. And it really is good. On the way down here today, I left early because I wanted to stop off in La Jolla and see my son. My son's down at UCSD, and he's a sophomore there, and he's having a lot of fun. When I got to the program, we weren't talking very much. When he saw my car drive onto the street, he would lock himself in his room in the closet, and he'd cry a lot. And he was terrified. And he didn't have friends, and he was thrown out of school after school after school. Literally thrown out. He was thrown out of 6 schools before he got into the first grade. Because they didn't want it, because he was an angry little kid. And we thought maybe he was retarded, and he was sitting to shrink. And I knew it had something to do with my behavior. And I didn't know what to do about it, and I felt so guilty. My first couple of years in the program, I went to the men's stage, and I kept thinking, how do I make this up to this kid? How do I make it up? And I really damaged his life. And they said, they told me exactly what to do. If you have a child, and you're feeling really guilty about the way you treated that child, and you want to make it up, I'll tell you what they told me is a very, very sophisticated approach. It was like, don't drink one day at a time. Go to meetings and work the steps, and it will be okay. And I tell you, that made no sense to me at all. I thought they were crazy. I really did. But nobody else would give me any better advice. And nothing else seemed to work. So we had spent a lot of money on drinks for the kid. And I have to tell you, after I got sober and just didn't drink one day at a time, somehow things got better for him. You know, he wound up going to Alatoon through some miracle, having to do with wonderful women in Al-Anon. And he started working steps of recovery, and before you know it, they let him back into the regular public school system, and then they promoted him and stuff, and they put him in a special class to get the kids finally, and about 5 years ago, he was invited to go to the Soviet Union as part of an exchange program. Not because his dad is sober, not because, you know, I have money in the bank, but because they thought he was an example of what American kids were like. And they never knew. They never knew how screwed up we had been. And that's a miracle of the 12 steps of recovery. And shortly after he was in the program, well, not shortly after, about 3 years afterwards, one night, we'd had an argument, and he told me that, he was working steps, and it was about time he'd make amends, because he had never told me he loved me, and he realized over the last several years of those meetings he had loved me, and he said, "Dad, you know, you never told me that you loved me, even though you made amends and did all these other things. We don't do that anymore, and I'd like to." And I said, "I really do love you." And we started doing it again, you know, every night when we were both home, we'd give each other a hug and a kiss before we went to bed. And sometimes I'd have to go to his room, sometimes I'd have to come up. But he'd also say goodnight to my wife, but he would always tell me he loved me. And I kind of miss him since he moved down here. And it was nice, because he had to walk me in my car because his grandpa sent some food down, a care package. And after he walked in the car, he came up and gave me a hug right in the parking lot, and we kissed. And I told him I loved him, and he told me he loved me, and we meant it. And we talk about stuff that I didn't even thought that anyone talked about. I didn't think that was ever possible for me, but it is. And that's part of the gift of the program. And when I left my house at 3:30 today, my wife was at the front door, and she kissed me, and she told me she loved me. And I said, "Well, you know, it's going to be okay." And she said, "Sure." She said, "Say hello to Joseph for me, and just remember, you know, be honest." And I said, "Okay, I'll try." And she said, "If you can't be honest, please make me sound good." So when she hears this tape, and I let her hear my tapes too. It's amazing. She came with me the first few times I shared, and she heard some things that she didn't know. You know, amazing stuff that I'd never told her. And you know, I get up at the podium, I don't know what I'm going to say. And she, there she was, and I was talking about all these, you know, really seedy, dreadful things. And I tend to get worse when she's there, too. And it's just, I said, "You mean you weren't really in the Air Force as a pilot?" I said, "No." "You didn't win all those awards and everything like you used to talk about?" I said, "No." She said, "You mean you didn't do this?" I said, "No." She said, "What else have you not told me?" And I just told her to keep coming back. You know, more shall be revealed. Anyway, that lady today is my best friend, and we've been married 11 and a half wonderful years. 10 rocky ones before then, but we have 21 and a half years, and a year and a half ago when I was 10 years sober and we were married 20 years, we got a chance to get married again, and a Jesuit priest with 19 years of sobriety married us up at a retreat house, and he was wearing a yarmulke and praying in Latin and then in Hebrew, and it was and there were 200 of our closest AA and Al-Anon friends there, and life was very good. And I have a job that I love today. I even work at it, and I try and do things properly, and I feel good, and I'm able to take naps during the day, and I'm able to listen to music. That was one of the things that alcoholism robbed from me. I was one of those alcoholics that found solutions before I found alcohol. My disease tells me I'm different and not as good, and I have problems and things like that. And one of my solutions to that is lying. I'm a very good liar. But the problem is when you start lying at a very young age, you have to have backup lies just in case your lie gets caught. And then you also have to remember what lie is told to what person. So it gets very complex. And if you're young, you have a lot of room in your brain to store all this information, and you have all the stuff floating around, what line you told to what person, you know, what time, and you have to constantly update it, you know? And that keeps your head very busy. And what happened to me was towards the end of my drinking, my head was so busy, I couldn't relax. And the only way I could get my mind off all the plans and the updates is to listen to talk shows. So I listen to talk radio all the time in cars. I don't know if any of you ever listen to talk radio. It's just terrible stuff. I mean, it really is not healthy. There should be a Surgeon General's warning on it, but I did. The only show I didn't listen to is that one show where the guy used to talk about going to AA or something or drinking. I just didn't want to hear that, I guess. I listened to talk shows, and to be simple, I couldn't listen to music on the radio. And that was kind of sick, and that was one of my losses. So that's a little bit what life is like now. I have a lot of fun. I just finished a stint as being the chairman of the San Fernando Valley AA Convention. That's actually now the biggest convention around. The Southern California Convention last year had about, I think, 2,800 people there. I think 4,600 people coming up there. It was the first time we moved to a different city. We moved from Sheraton Universal out to Burbank. And it was kind of exciting. It was real busy. And I learned that I don't work well with other people. You know, it shouldn't surprise me. I remember, in fact, I showed my son when he got some problems in school and they sent home a bad report card as far as his behavior. I just wanted to let him know that that didn't mean he wouldn't be a success in business, because I was pretty successful in business. I took out my old first grade report card, under works and plays well with others, I had a U. And, you know, some things get well slower than others, because I still don't work and play well with other people, which is why I'm self-employed. And I don't have employees. I'm kind of an independent consultant, and every time I try to work with other people, it just is really painful. And it's something I'm working on, and this convention was certainly an opportunity for growth. It nearly cost me my marriage and my sobriety, but I made it through. And thanks to the fact that I've been so active in the program, and thanks to people like the guys I sponsor. See, what they do for me is they force me to behave better than my natural inclinations would allow me to. My natural mind will say, do a lot of things that aren't right. And then I have to think, well, what will they think of me? I feel connected to a lot of other people. I have a home group, a beginner's men's fair. When I was 7 months sober, they elected me secretary. They actually railroaded me into it. And just my sponsor put in a word and said he needs something, he's been busy. And just last week, I got elected a group rep in that group. First time I'm working general service. So I try and stay active, and I try and do these things because I so desperately need to. And you wouldn't think a guy with my background would really need to be that active. See, I don't come from an alcohol family. You know, my parents hardly drank. Certainly, I never saw either of them drunk, and I never heard of either of them ever drunk. And to this day, my mom's passed away, but my dad, I don't think he drinks at all anymore. Just doesn't agree with him when he's old and not well. And see, I don't qualify for those adult people who were formerly children, who used to live next door to people who drank or whatever. I mean, I just don't know about that kind of stuff. I can't blame other people. I mean, I can if you want. I'd love to blame other people. When I came to the program, I blamed everybody. I blamed my wife. I blamed the kid. I blamed my clients. I blamed the street I lived on, the religion I was brought up in, my parents, my brother, everybody. And I'll tell you today, it's a tremendous relief not to have to blame other people. Because as long as I blamed them, there was no way out for me. Because I couldn't change them, and I knew I couldn't. I tried all my life to change other people, and I really couldn't. But once I realized that the problem was within me, then I had something I could work with. And the guys at the men's dad said, oh yeah, you can work with that. We have this way of working with it. It's the same way you work on getting your kid fixed up, or your wife fixed up, or your business fixed up. You know, you get a sponsor, you go to the meeting, and you work the steps. That was their answer for everything. You know, I think that a lot of them had too much to drink when they were younger, you know? Maybe I took some weird drugs or something, and, you know, that was one-track mind, you know. That's all they ever said, you know. Get a sponsor, go to meetings, work the steps. So I did. And amazing things began to happen. But that's why my family, you know, because my son got into Allison, and because I've been involved with conventions almost since the beginning, really at the beginning. I don't know if they have men's stags down here. I think they do. If any of you new guys go to the men's stags, you find that some interesting things go on at them. Afterwards, a lot of the times they go out for coffee. And they play a game called, Can You Bottom This? And, you know, no matter what one person's done, somebody's done it worse. You know, I've had 3 502s. Oh, that's nothing. I had 10 502s. Oh, boy, I had 10 arrests. Oh, I tell you, you know, so Can You Bottom This? Being a joiner, I got into this game also, and I used to go out after the beginner's men's stag, and I'd play around with them. And it was okay when they talked about being liars and, you know, abusive people or whatever. I was willing to, you know, just be one of the guys about in the middle. But then they started talking about being a thief. And I hope I have time to get around to it, but I was a pretty bad thief. The particular crime I was involved with, which the only one that actually got me into the federal prison, involved about $17 billion. So a guy was talking about, oh, I did this and I did that. I said, yeah, well, I did such and such with $17 billion. Well, I didn't realize it at the time, but Hugh Douglas, who was chairman of the San Fernando Valley Convention 12 years ago, was there at the table having coffee. And he said, I want you to be my treasurer. So here I was, pretty new, and I was the treasurer of this convention. I've worked on the conventions ever since. That's why I got drafted. Anyway, so, you know, but because I've been involved in conventions, because my son went to Alateen, I wound up going to some Alateen meetings, especially at conventions. And if you ever get to one, there's a great convention down here. In fact, the Southern Cal Convention is coming back down to San Diego next year. Stop off at an Alateen meeting. Just hear the share. Hear the honesty. It's really neat. They work the same 12 steps we do. Even though my parents didn't drink, and even though I don't come from an alcoholic family, I identify with the feelings of those kids. See, my dad's a gambler. He's a compulsive gambler. And because of that, sometimes he'd come home early, and sometimes he'd come home late, and sometimes he wouldn't come home. And there was abuse in the family. And it was craziness. You know, doctors, you know, nowadays, you know, some of the highfalutin, fancy, dancy meetings in L.A., they use all these medical terms like dysfunctional and whatever. We were screwed up. That's what it boiled down to. We were a real screwed up family, and what I learned from that family is if you have a problem, you don't tell anybody. Because in my family, if you had a problem and you told them, they'd use it against you. You know, next time there's a fight, he'd say, oh, your son did this, and your son did that, and she said, your son, and they use it against you, and you feel real bad. So I learned not to tell people my problems, no matter how badly I need a solution. And when you're 4 and 5 years old, and then when you grow up and you're 35 and 40 years old, and you don't ask other people for help with your problems, you wind up making up your own solutions. And that's what I did. For 35 years, I made up my own solutions to problems. I have to tell you, when I wrote my inventory in this program, the inventory process is something you start doing almost right away, but it's really written down in the fourth step, and that's when you write down something about yourself. And you look for patterns. It's not a confession or anything like that. It's like a self-appraisal. That's what an inventory is in anything. And when I did this inventory, when I did the self-appraisal, what I discovered about myself was that my solutions were always worse than my problems. My solutions got me in more trouble than my problems ever would have. I mean, from lying, to cheating, to living in a fantasy world. You know, my life at certain points in time was so bad, I bury myself in books and read and live in a fantasy world. Now, I also had a very good memory. I mean, you have a good memory, and you read a lot, and you can lie a lot and cheat a lot, you do very well in school. And I grew up in New York City. I was born during the Second World War. I know I don't look that old, but they skip people a lot, and I was skipped twice in elementary school. So when I was 15 and a half years old, I was a freshman at New York University Engineering College in the Bronx. I was living in the dorm. I was the youngest person living in the dorm, and it was the first year they had women on campus. And I was doing okay academically. I fit right in. I could do the slide rule, and I could look up logarithms, and I was doing okay with chemistry and engineering drawing, and I was carrying 21 credits just like all the 18-year-olds. But on weekends, I was lost. I was terrified. Just there'd be these dances, and there'd be women there, and I didn't know how to behave socially. I didn't know how to interact with people, especially not with girls. And here I was with it, and there were 8 guys to every girl. And I'm 5'5". I'm wearing cowboy boots, so I wasn't taller, but I'm 5'5". I had pretty bad acne thing, and I couldn't dance at all. And there were all the new dancers, you know, this was like the late 50s, and all the new dancers were coming in, you know. They just changed over from one group of dancers to the other. They were doing line dances for the first time. Strange stuff. And I couldn't do any of it. And I just sat in the corner, terrified, mortified, and knowing that everybody else was okay and I wasn't. I do that a lot, by the way. I look at you, and I know that you're doing okay. But I know deep inside I'm in trouble. I've always been comparing my insides to your outsides, and I've always been a loser when I do that. I want to point out to you that when I'm feeling really good, I never compare myself to other people. So if you're sitting there and you're pretty new, and you're saying, hey, that guy up there, he's doing okay, you know, he did this and that, and he drove up in a new car, and you look pretty good to me too, guys and gals. So don't fool yourself. Don't put yourself down any more than the disease has already put you down. But I did that all the time. Here I was, 15 and a half years old, at a dance at the St. Nicholas of Palatine Social Hall down the street from NYU, and terrified week after week. And I couldn't go to my parents and tell them I was afraid and didn't know what to do, because they really would use against me. They pick on each other. They have a fight or do something. And I couldn't go to the dorm and tell the guys, like I can now, hey, guys, I'm afraid. I didn't think that was possible to ever tell anybody that. And what I did was finally one day come up with my own solution. It was wonderful. I was on my way to the dance. I had to go down Loring Place in the Bronx, and I stopped off at the, I think it was the 80 Pi Fraternity House, and they had a beer bus that night, and I had a drink. Actually, I had two. I've always had two. Ask my wife, I've always had two. And I don't, 2 watts, I don't know, but there were 2 kegs or something. And I got to the dance, and it was much, much better. Now, just, some people may not understand, I see there's an Aladdin back there, and that's good. See, some people think that when we drink, we feel totally different. And, you know, that's not the way it affects this alcohol. I never felt like I was 6'4". I never felt I could dance like Fred Astaire or had wonderful clear skin. What alcohol did to me was make me acceptable as I was. You see, I'd have a few drinks and go to the dance, and suddenly my keen mind would realize that even though I'm only 5'5", most of the girls are shorter than that anyway. You know? It's cool. And you know, maybe I go out to the park a lot and, you know, have some 7 and 7. That was a drink they had back in Swiss News. Seagram 7 and 7 Up. And I'd have a few drinks of 7 and 7 in the parking lot. And I'd go back in and I'd realize, even though my acne was pretty bad, the lights were off and I had that crazy ball with all the mirrors on it going around and around. And nobody would notice. No, nobody would notice. You know, and I'd go back out and one of my friends was in the school band. And he had some non-habit-forming marijuana. And, you know, and I'd suddenly realize that even though I didn't know how to dance, I was smart enough to watch other people's feet. And when they moved their feet, I could move my feet. And I could fake it. And what alcohol did to me was make me okay. Make me acceptable so I could go up to the girls and ask them to dance. And while I was at it, I asked them for a lot more. And I was reasonably successful being a good liar and having a good memory. And some of the things I told these gals to get them to go along with me are just amazing. Fortunately, I don't remember most of their names. It's impossible to make amends. It would take a long time because I was not an honest person. And I roared through people's lives like a tornado. Because once I discovered that alcohol worked for me, I could do anything I wanted. Anything. Everything. I was an atheist by then. I was a real atheist. I wasn't like an agnostic. I was a member of the American Atheist Association. I tithed. I actually sent money to Madeline Murray O'Hare. I did stuff like that. And, you know, and because I wasn't worried about retribution or an afterlife or punishment beyond the grave, you know, it was okay. If you're new and thinking about the possibility, if you ever should drink again, of becoming an atheist. I say it's not all great. There are some drawbacks. There are very few holidays. And think before you do it. I discovered that that because I could lie and do all kinds of things. This was by then the early 60s. And it was, if you've seen the movie Hair, you know what New York was like in the 60s. It was you know sex, drugs, and rock and roll. And I tried a little of each, thank you. A lot of some. And I have to tell you that it would have bothered me at one point in time. I would have felt that some of the stuff was wrong, but if I felt bad about something, I knew how to feel better. I was okay. I just had a few drinks. And I began drinking more and more. And I'll tell you that I discovered something else about myself even before I did my inventory. I knew it. I didn't put it in words until I wrote the inventory, but I knew it when it was happening. I knew that I always wanted people to like me. In fact, if the truth be known, if I was really honest back then, I would tell you that I wanted people to love me. And if I couldn't get your love, I'd settle for attention. And I'd do whatever was necessary. You know, I take exams under your name. I'd go and take an exam for you if I was supposed to mark the class. And if there was a civil rights march, I'd go on it, whether I believed in it or not. And I'd go out and I'd throw eggs at politicians, even if I didn't know who they were, if you were doing it. You know, I'd go to parties and go to bed with people and do all kinds of things just to get your attention, just to be accepted. And if I woke up in the morning and felt bad about it, I knew the solution. Just a few drinks and it'll feel better. And that's the way my life was. And the interesting thing was I began to isolate more and more, and I began to feel worse and worse between drinks. Because what happened to me was I did all this stuff to get people to like me, and then if anybody liked me, I realized that they were so stupid they fell for all this bull, and I had no respect for them. How could you respect anybody who would like a person like me? Tom probably remembers the Groucho Marx line, he'd never want to join a country club that would accept him as a member. And it was the same kind of thing. I certainly didn't want any part of any gal that would have something to do with a guy as bad as me. And it kind of makes you a loner. It makes you a loner. And I got more and more isolated. But you know, being a little compulsive and having all sorts of stimulants to stay awake and study, I graduated and moved into Manhattan. I decided to study to become a mathematician and actuary, and at the age of 24, I had become the youngest actuary in the world. And I was dating the number two lead girl in Fiddler on the Roof, the one who played the oldest daughter. And I had invested in cabaret and real friendly with the people in the theater, because I lived in the west side of Manhattan where the theater people were. And I was about to all those wild parties there. I even had a car, because I was an actuary, which is made a damn good salary back then. And I was drinking a fifth of scotch a day. And I stopped bragging about how much I could hold, and I started covering up and lying about it. And when my last roommate moved out of me because I was just too weird, I still had bottles around my own house. And I knew something was seriously wrong. I didn't have a clue. Didn't have a clue. I was still an atheist. I subscribed to, you know, certain other things that were almost religious, like Zen Buddhism. And I burned incense, and I chanted, and stuff like that. I never had a home sale and sold flowers at the airport, but I did most other things. I took well, power of positive thinking and all that stuff. And it never seemed to work. And then one day, my employer, which was the Equitable Life in New York, introduced a group psychological insurance for their employees, only for employees. It was, they wanted a test to see if it would pay to sell it to the public, to include therapy in group insurance. So all of us were encouraged to go for therapy. And, you know, why not? You know, I'll try it. And the first kind of therapy I tried, because I knew I had a problem, I thought it was great, because I really didn't have the money to spend for some reason. You know, I had a really good job, I never seemed to have money. And I thought it would be really nice to try some of this therapy. And the first thing I tried was transactional analysis. And that was really becoming popular, then Dr. Eric Byrne, who wrote all the books on it, who started it, was actually teaching the therapy and running a group Tuesday and Thursday nights right over Manny Wolf Bar on the east side. Manny Wolf is the ground and it's like the third floor. And every Tuesday and Thursday night, if you're not familiar with transactional analysis, you know, you're talking about your inner child and your punished adult and the logical person, and it's all kind of mathematical, which really appealed to me. And the concept boiled down to, you know, I'm okay and you're okay. And that was in several of his books. And what I really learned in the transactional analysis was that I'm okay and you're okay. Mostly I learned that martinis were okay, though, because I would go to these things and I realized how I'd been torturing my inner child so much. I felt so bad about it. I just had to go down to Manny Wolf's afterwards and you know, drink martinis. That's all they served there. And I had to give it up after about 7 months finally because even though the insurance company paid 100% of the therapy bill, they didn't pay any of my bar bill. And I just couldn't afford it anymore. So I switched from transactional analysis to primal scream therapy, which was done in Greenwich Village. You'd go into a doctor's office and he'd say, you're a parent. And you'd yell and yell and yell. And they'd say, your job, and you'd yell and you'd yell. And you'd say, chief. If you yelled, you'd talk about it, I guess. I was a city boy. I don't know about those things. Because San Diego County, I don't know. I don't know if I felt any better. My drinking certainly changed. I didn't remember decreasing, but I switched from martinis to things like Southern Comfort and Rock and Rye because my throat always hurts. I stopped smoking for a while also because my throat hurts so bad from all this yelling. Finally, you know, I just lost my voice altogether. I couldn't go to work for a few days, and I just had to give up primal scream. My last encounter with therapy, as I said, I'm sharing this stuff with you only because, you know, you might not have to go through this. I mean, therapies are still around, and they work. Therapy works for folks, for Earth people. I'm a different variety. I'm basically incapable of being honest with a therapist unless I'm sober and working a program. So my first job is to get sober, and then if I need therapy, I might be able to do it. My third encounter with therapy was Gestalt therapy. And I would like to share this because it is kind of interesting. That's around, too. We go to the East Village. They have this old Turkish bath they converted to this main Gestalt therapy center. And you get a little lock and you put all your clothes in it. I mean, everything. In fact, the woman has to get earrings out. And no socks, no shoes, no nothing. No watches, no rings. Girls keep her okay. Then you go into the room and you sit in a group around an oval rug and you discuss how you were that day and what your problems were like and difficult times you were having and any insights that you've had in the last few days and that's what you do for the hour. It was kind of like doing a naked fix step, really. You very quickly discover your shortcomings. I don't think any of the guys were late, but the second time I went to the Gestalt group, I made the mistake of not being drunk, and I was so mortified and embarrassed by my apparent lack of control that I left and never showed up again. So that's, I have to tell you that, as a result of coming to you folks and trying to get honest and trying to work this program and taking direction from a sponsor, who was not intelligent enough to give me direction, the only therapy that I've really found necessary for the last 11 and a half years has been the 12 steps of recovery in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And for that, my insurance company is very grateful. And it's wonderful. Before the meeting, Tom and I were talking about stuff with people going to different groups and stuff and things like that. And I'll tell you that at one point in time, when I was about 4 years sober, my wife and I were having one of our numerous bouts of disagreements, whatever. You know, I don't know why, but we just do this from time to time when we disagree. And she doesn't do it my way, I guess. And I was tempted for the first time really to try some sort of marriage therapy or encounter group or something like that. And I went to this one fellow who I see he and his wife have been around for about 18 or 19 years, and I said, have you ever tried going to therapy or anything like that, or, you know, family therapy or counseling or marriage encounters? Or, I said, Archie, it seems to me you've been sober about 4 years now, and, you know, the program's done pretty good by you so far. I mean, it doesn't look like it's life-threatening. He said, why not give AA a chance? You know, it doesn't happen overnight. You're still young. I mean, he was significantly older. And he said, why not give the program a chance? And, you know, it's amazing. About 2 weeks later, this fellow who I had known, who's president of a major soda company, who I'd met through business, his wife called me, and he was in the hospital for detoxing. I never knew he was drunk. He was detoxing in the hospital, and she asked me to visit him. And she came over to my house because she had a young son, and she wanted to ask my wife some questions. And exactly 2 weeks after that conversation with Jack, this fellow Arlen asked me to be a sponsor, and his wife asked my wife to be her sponsor in Al-Anon. And we began going down a road where we still sponsor this couple. And my wife and I don't talk about people we sponsor at all. We really don't. But whenever Arlen told me something that his wife was doing wrong and why he's so angry at her, I realized, and I told him, it's your fault. You should be doing this and this. And I realized I'd been guilty of the same thing. And I realized I had a lot to learn about being a husband. And I did it without going to marriage and counseling therapy and stuff like that. I did it through the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's amazing, you know, what you can learn in this program if you give it a chance. And some people say, you know, other programs are good to tune up your program, work better 6 and 7 steps. And I was a firm believer in that. I said, you know, once you've worked the steps, once you're sober up, you might want to go and visit. I had a very bad experience with that recently. In fact, what I was alluding to earlier was, around about the time I was 10 years old, one of my character defects popped its ugly face in mine, and I decided to relive my childhood and get involved in all sorts of sexual exciting things, which is something that some people do, you know, I've discovered through sharing it and having other people share with me. And among other things I tried, because it was suggested, I shared about it, I prayed about it, I spoke to my wife about it, we worked on it, and this was pretty bad. And I was afraid I'd drink, or die, or destroy that family that I'd worked on so long. And it was definitely a defective character. And I had to go to some 12-step program that was involved with people who were compulsive in that area. And I went to a couple of meetings. And you know what I discovered? I discovered that probably works real good for people where that's their problem. But see, my problem is I'm an alcoholic. And I know how to feel good about things. I can just drink over it. And I knew for a fact that that was not the program for me. Like the third time I was there, when a guy said, well, I had this urge to go into this video thing and do this and that and this and that. He said, but fortunately, I just went home and smoked a joint and took a Valium and I didn't have to do it. And they all applauded. Wonderful. My solution to the 12 steps comes in having God remove my defects of character. Having God work with me on removing them. And I can't use little tricks like a little Valium or not have it for me marijuana. And I'll tell you, I met a fellow there that I was talking to who had 7.5 years of sobriety, and I think it was close to the second meeting, I was nearly going to ask him to sponsor me in this area of my life. But my sponsor, you know, just had no experience directly. And, you know, the week after that, he decided to drink again. They would make him feel better. And that's the last time I ever went to that kind of a meeting. And I called somebody else in AA, who was a lot of time, 30-some years. And I told him the problem openly and honestly. And he suggested I share it at a big meeting and get that shit out so I don't have to live with it. Because he said, your stick is your secret. And I did that a couple of weeks ago. And I have to tell you, it works. And I don't feel the urge to do that. I don't want to do that. I have to tell you, if you're married, if you're a guy and you're married and you're sober, misbehaving is a real dangerous thing. On the other hand, what I have to tell you also is my experience since then. And I've heard this from somebody else. In fact, the first fellow who told me not to go to therapy said this about his life after he got sober. He says, having 100 different experiences with a woman you love is much better than having the same experience over and over and over again with different people. And that's been my experience. So, you know, I'm real pleased. I'm real pleased to say that in spite of the fact, you know, I don't get invited to orgies and things like that, and nobody's offered to do a porno picture of me lately, I'm happy today, you know, and I can sleep soundly, and I don't worry about things, and I don't wake up this way. I feel I can come to a group and honestly share, and I have to, you know, kind of bury things that I'm afraid of saying. That's real neat. I what was my drink story? I drank a lot. You know, I just really did it terrible. Everything in New York was really screwed up, and the therapy didn't work, and nothing seemed to work. And finally, I got a job offer to come to California, and I jumped at it. I just jumped. Because I knew that once I came to California, those problems I was having back in the East Coast would end. And they did, you know. I was a pretty bad drunk towards the end. I was drinking a lot. And, you know, I'd wake up at sunrise having passed out in Central Park. Or I'd wake up on the subway, you know, like 5 in the morning, you know, somewhere in Brooklyn or Harlem or somewhere where I didn't even know where I was. Because I'd get on the subway drunk and I'd pass out and I'd wake up in strange places. And, you know, I moved to California, and not once did I wake up at Central Park or on a subway. And it was a big plus. And I didn't get any trouble at first. I drank a lot. I know I had a company expense account. I had a company car. I had use of a company plane. It was an exciting, really exciting company. I was in my mid-20s then, and I was the head actuary for a very big international company with mutual funds, insurance companies, banks, all kinds of things. And after about 6 months, the president of the company called me up to his office and said, Arch, we have a problem of we overstated the profits of your company by about $1.5 million. I said, that's no problem. Saying a company as big as us, we can correct it next quarter. We'll just say less. And we'll correct it next quarter. That's not a big deal. No, you don't understand. If we say we made less money, our stock will go down, and we won't be able to buy as many other companies. And also, I was kind of hoping that our pictures would be in Fortune magazine as the fastest growing company, and that would kill us. And you know, I used to talk about this. I've always wanted to work good for other people. I've always wanted to, but I didn't want to do anything to do it. And for some reason, I trusted this guy, and I said something to him that I don't know why I said, but I said, yeah, Stan, if I can say this in my resume, but I'm a very good liar, and I don't get caught. Because I can make up lies for lies, and I'm very quick. And if you trust me with my own department and my own little computer, we can make whatever profits you want. And he did. And within 3 years, that $1.5 million accounting error became $17 billion. And we had more life insurance in force than there were people in the United States. And it got out of hand. That's what happened. It really got out of hand. Because when you drink a little and you do these crazy things, one thing leads to another. And if you start lying and you start making things up, and the next thing you know, you have to do other things that you didn't plan on doing. Like, the SEC will come in and say, well, you say you made that money. What did you do with it? You say, well, I bought bonds. And they say, well, let's see the bonds. The next thing you know, you're counterfeiting. And then they say, well, we're going to do an audit. So they check themselves into a hotel in Beverly Hills to do the audit on you, and the next thing you know, you're tapping their phones or breaking into their rooms at night because, you know, you have to know what they're going to look for. And you begin doing all these things, and it gets crazier and crazier. And you know, for a person like me, you know, I wasn't afraid about retribution. I just didn't want to go to jail. Guys like me don't do well in jail, you know. I had an image. So by this time I was about 28. I was about 28, and I thought, you know, young guys like me, I didn't realize the young ones are like the 18-year-olds. They don't want anybody as old as me. But I was 28 years old, and I was terrified. And I knew the whole thing was falling apart. And I knew that I was losing something inside of me that made me a human being. And some people call it the soul, or the spirit, or the gestalt, or something. But there's something inside of all of us, even you, that separates you from animals. And I was losing it, whatever it was. Because what would happen was, you know, I do these things every day and every night, and I'd get up in the morning, and I wouldn't be drunk, and I'd have to look myself in the mirror when I shaved. And I knew I'd have to go to work to keep this fraud up one more day. And I'd look in the mirror, and I'd tell myself that I wouldn't feel this way. I'd just get to work and do the job. It's work. Don't feel it. Don't feel it. And I think if you tell yourself you're not going to feel something long enough, you start feeling it. And that thing inside of you starts dying. Up in Los Angeles, a lot of young people come into the program these days, and they use a really powerful way of describing it. They say that there's like a hole in their guts that the wind rushes through. And I like that. I really do. When they say that, that's the kind of feeling it is, when there's something missing. And I knew I had to find something to make up for that missing part of me. I had to find some sort of power greater than myself. I had to find a higher power that would make me like a human being again. And I looked. I really did. I made lists. I put down criteria, and I searched all over to find this power greater than myself. And I finally found her. She worked on the sixth floor. She had brown hair and big brown beautiful eyes, and she wore hot pants. And her hair was longer than the bottom of her hot pants. And I saw her in the elevator in Century City, and I made a decision that I wanted what she had, and I was willing to go to England to get it. And I knew I'd have to take certain steps to do it, and I did. And it's something she bought. But I persevered. I finally got a date with her. I took her to a party in Santa Monica. And it was a Friday night. It was a friend's house. And by this time, my drinking was making me do a lot of erratic things. Like I was taking off all my clothes at the wrong time, or putting on all my clothes at the wrong time. Or I was telling people precisely what I thought of them. And I didn't want to do it to this gal before I knew she was something special. And so I decided to use my drug of choice at that time, which was green chartreuse, the Brandon. And when I did that, I didn't take my clothes off or anything like that. I just fell asleep. I passed out, is what green chartreuse did to me. And I didn't throw up either. For a while, Drambuie was really good with scotch. But if you do Drambuie and scotch, you pass out, but sometimes you throw up. But green chartreuse, you just pass out without throwing up. So I knew I was going to do some weird things, so I asked the host for some green chartreuse so I wouldn't do anything weird. And the next thing I remember is the next morning waking up, and the phone was ringing, and this buddy of mine put the phone in my hand, and it was this gal, and she said, "Gee, Art, hope you're okay. I live with my parents, and I couldn't stay around all night to take care of you, but I made sure your car was parked, and I put your keys in your coat pocket. And I put you on the couch and covered you up and put the teddy bear in your arms. And I hope you understand why I couldn't stay around to take care of you." And I said, "Oh, yeah." She said, "Well, because I really did have to go, but I hope you'll call me again." And I put the phone down, and I realized that woman had just apologized to me for my bad behavior. And I knew that I had found the right gal for me. Within a week, we were engaged. And we were married about 8 months later. And, I didn't realize at the time that passing out on a potential Al-Anon is like enough to put them in heat. And, that marriage was a menage a trois. It was the beginnings of a threesome. It was Carrie, me, and the booze. Because wherever there was me and Carrie, there was the booze, which were honeymoon for everything. And she doesn't come from an alcoholic family either, so she didn't know what the problem was. We knew we had a problem, but we didn't know what it was. And we tried a lot of the things that young couples try when there's a problem. We tried spending a lot of time together. She tried really supporting me. And she tried giving me a lot of freedom, spending time away. And she tried staying home with me, going to work with me. And then she tried getting a job away. And then we tried having a child. And it got worse and worse. So we finally decided what the reasons must be. By this time, I had gotten fired from that company because the FBI had taken it over. And, so I started this little accounting company, and people calling me all the time, all hours of the night, they asked me to do stuff. Stuff I promised them weeks earlier, but it's still there, And then the little kid of ours was just getting into all kinds of trouble. So that's what the problem was, and we didn't know what to do about it. Fortunately, I did have an intervention played on me. It was before the times, it was before 34 and all that stuff. They didn't really have interventions, but this is the Federal Ninth Circuit paid an intervention. They indicted me on 52 counts of criminal conspiracy. and we took whatever money I had left, which wasn't much. Part of the insanity of this disease is I never took any money personally out of this. It was billions of dollars, but it was all make-believe. It was all ego and craziness. It was not stolen. So we had a little bit of money, and we took it and hired this attorney. And then once the check had cleared, he told me to plead guilty, because I was, and I did because I was, and I was sent to 3 years in federal prison. And I served 17 months at the Federal Correctional Institution of Terminal Island, the medium security prison. Where it was interesting, that was the one federal prison that had women inmates also. So it turns out, in fact, it was nice because a couple of the ladies there, I see at meetings nowadays. And the fact was that while I was in Terminal Island, I didn't drink at all, and I didn't use any drugs. And I never really saw any alcohol. I think people made Pruno. I heard about it, but I didn't see it. And as far as the drugs go, that was very, very infrequent. It was really a different group of people. But I hung up with most people. I got along with lots of the different kinds of people. I made friends for the first time. It's funny. Take away the alcohol, and I suddenly developed a personality or something, I guess. And I worked out with the guys at the rate pile, by then the Watergate people were beginning to come in, and I'd get friends with them, and the mafia people, and it was kind of fun. Anyway, I hadn't been drinking, and my wife would come visit me. The last year, I was in minimum security, even though it's a medium security prison. I was allowed to go in a little grassy area outside of the main gate, still behind fences, where we could have like a picnic dinner. So every day she'd come, she'd drive all the way down from Van Nuys to San Pedro over the Vincent Thomas Bridge and bring me dinner, homemade dinner. And she was still running the business and making the mortgage payments. And every night we'd have the same conversation. She said, Warren, because you're going to be out of here soon, and your memories come back. Although I lost my memory towards the end anyway, I was drinking so much. We didn't know that the fact that I wasn't drinking got my memory back. But, she said, Warren, it'd be great, I've kept the business going, and there'll be a job for you. And, my parents haven't given up on us, and they'll be there to help support us. And we're all healthy, and Joseph is doing okay. And it'll be wonderful. They've taken the top off our phone, and you're not in the newspapers anymore. And it won't be great. You get out here, you won't have to drink like that anymore. And I had to agree with it. I thought I wouldn't have to drink like that anymore without all those problems. And in June of 1976, I was released from Terminal Island. My wife picked me up and drove me home. And I looked at her house and it was really beautiful, and I couldn't wait to get into the house. And I had a job waiting, I had a car waiting. I really didn't have a care in the world. I was ready to start over again. And I was 33 or 34 years old. And that night, I got drunk, and the next morning I drank out of a bottle in my office. They read it tonight. First gal read it. It's cunning, baffling, and powerful. And what my sponsor told me at least three times a week for my first 5 years is, it's jealous and it's patience. It's jealous of this wonderful life I have, and it's patient. It's waiting for me. It's waiting for me to say no to Peggy. I can't drive all the way down to Lemon Grove. I mean, tomorrow's mother's day. I have to have a good night's sleep. I'm cooking brunch tomorrow. I can't drive down here. I'm an important guy. I shouldn't drive this far. It's waiting for me to hang up on the newcomer to call because he's arrived to a meeting or they just have to talk late at night. It's waiting for me to fool around on my wife again. It's waiting for me to steal from my clients. It's waiting for me to stop praying. And it'll be in there. It'll be in there like that. And I've seen it. You've seen it. You've seen it. People with a lot of time begin drifting away because sobriety is no longer their main priority. And I'll tell you from experience, I was drifting away. I was drifting away. And it was only through the grace of God and the fact that I had built up a lot of points in AA by going to a lot of meetings and working a lot of steps and sponsoring a lot of guys that I'm here and sober and alive today. And that really is a gift. Because I have to remember that my disease is stronger in me today than it was 12 years ago. See, I go to a lot of meetings. You know, I've probably been to 4,000 meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've been to a lot of Al-Anon meetings, too, when they invite me. And I think my disease is stronger in me today than it was then. Because every time I've been in one of those meetings, my disease is in the next room and it's doing push-ups. And it's pretty strong today. And I never want to go back to that. I never want to go back to that life. And I don't even mean the years in prison and the years drinking and hurting the family. After I got out, I had 5 more years of drinking to do. And there was none of this expense account, fancy stuff, $1 billion, this and that. It was the quiet misery of losing every bit of self-respect and dignity that I had left in me. When I was ready to die and hurt myself enough, I hit a bottom. And my wife didn't holler at me or call me names. She just said that she loved me and she was just really sorry, but I had to make a decision of either her or the booze. And I told her I'd let her know the next day. And I thought about it that night. And I'd known a lot of people in AA, and I thought I understood AA. You know, the religion. I knew these guys prayed a lot. I'd never been to a meeting, but I knew all about it. I knew it worked for people who belonged in AA. I just go to bars and suggest certain people go to AA. I had clients who were sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous, and they told me a lot about their lives. And I knew that they were basically good people who got in trouble because they drank too much. And they got addicted to it or something, and they'd get 502s or beat up their wives or something, go bankrupt. And then they'd go to AA, they'd stop drinking, and they would get back to being good people again. And that is great. If you knew, by the way, that's not how AA works. But that's what I perceived it to be. And the reason I thought it wouldn't work for me was I knew that basically I was not a good person. See, I knew that if you just take away the alcohol, I'm going to feel worse. And I have to tell you that that night I stopped drinking because I put together my behavior and my drinking and decided regardless of how much it hurt, regardless of how bad I was, I would not drink because I couldn't stand to hurt myself and my family anymore. And I stopped drinking. And the next 2 weeks were the worst 2 weeks of my life. Because I had all the shame and all the guilt that I had been covering up all those years, and I had nothing to cover it with. Nothing. Fortunately, a couple of friends of mine who knew I decided not to drink had told me that alcoholism is not Valium deficiency, and I should not ease off with a little chemical help. So I did it just without drinking, and I sweat a lot, and I had the flyaways. I'd be talking to somebody with a pen in my hand, and I'd fly, and I just wouldn't know where. And I sweat a lot. In fact, we had to recover a couch that I slept on. I was sleeping on the couch back then, by the way. It's one of the other pluses of being a practicing alcoholic in my family. You get a change of scenery every night. And I was really unhappy. And I don't remember a lot of it, but I hear about it from neighbors and friends and family retainers and whatever. My wife finally called one of these fellows who was in AA, who was a client of mine, and said, "Oh, Art hasn't had a drink in 2 weeks, and he's either going to kill me or kill himself. Please get him to a meeting." So Jim called me. Jim was not a very successful member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Up to that time, his nickname had been 10 Day Jim. He had a very long, very unsuccessful history with Alcoholics Anonymous. They said that they think he 12-stepped Bill Wilson one time. He'd been trying to make this program many, many years in many, many cities and many, many groups, and ever since he put any time together. Anyway, Jim saved my life. He told me that he saved my life. And he said the 5 words that saved my life. And if you're here tonight, probably somebody said them to you. And I hope for your sake that you can remember who it was. Because it's kind of a fun thing to keep in your little memory scrapbook, and that is, the 5 words for me was, "Let's go to a meeting." And we did. We went to a meeting in Ohio Street. It was a Saturday night. It was the Ohio Street Beachcombers meeting. It wasn't a Pacific group. It was a Beachcombers. And they were kind of like a low-bottom group. Even Serenity Slam wouldn't go there. That's a barrier. That is a, I went there, actually we were supposed to go to a real fancy meeting at first, but the fancy meeting was another night. Jim had not really been going to meetings for a while then. So Jim took me over to this meeting on Ohio Street, and the guy who was leading the meeting was not wearing a shirt or shoes. He was wearing jeans. And it was a cold night, by the way. It was September. And end of September. And he was wearing chains. I mean, well, not biting, you know, not the old Lucci kind of chains. He was wearing like bicycle chains or motorcycle chains or something. And he introduced this girl who was the main speaker, and she talked about how she got sober, her sex life got better. And I was really confused. I don't know much about that meeting. But I'll tell you what I do remember. I remember that I felt safe. For the first time in years, I felt safe. And when they asked me the alcoholics, I raised my hand, and the newcomers, and at the end of the meeting, they all stood up and held hands and said something. I don't know what they said, but I moved my lips because I wanted them to think I knew what they were saying, because I so badly wanted part of it. And at the end, this buddy of mine said, get the book, get the book. So I went up to this guy without a shirt, and I said, I gotta get the book. He said, oh, you mean the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. We have it for sale here at our cost of $4.65. But if you're short of funds, we'll be glad. I said, wait a minute. Looks like you folks need the money more than me. Here's $5, you keep the change. I got home with that book, and one of the other things, one of my other problems, by the way, was I couldn't sleep. In addition to having the flyaways and sweating, I just couldn't sleep when I first started drinking. And I think that's natural, by the way. That's what they told me. That's what I tell everybody else, too, practicing medicine or something. But it happens to a lot of folks, and eventually it goes away. And reading the big book does help, by the way. There are a lot of things that help. Getting your mind off yourself helps, I guess. You have to be careful what different stuff. I'll get off. I went there and I identified with the program. I identified with Bill Wilson. He was about the same age I was when he got sober. He had hurt his family so much, and yet at the end he was able to make things right with him. I identified with a car salesman who put scotch in his milk because he wouldn't get drunk. And I had done that with the same result. The accountant who was so successful, he had to get drunk. I had done that. I loved this stuff. I loved everything about it. I didn't believe the God stuff. I thought that was just kind of symbolic. You know, like, I've been to a lot of different churches, and I knew most of the people didn't believe either, and they talk about God a lot, too. So I thought this is just kind of symbolic, and you really don't have to do this stuff. So I started going to the meetings, and they tortured me into getting a sponsor, so I got this neighbor of mine, Polish, and structural engineer. I mean, I was a chemical engineer, NYU, structural engineer from some Polish school or something. I don't know. Clearly, he couldn't help me, but, like, he would do things that were so foolish. He knew I was an atheist, because I told him all the time. And then one day on the way to a meeting, he says, you know, you got to start praying. I said, John, I'm an atheist. He said, doesn't matter, you got to pray. Do you know what an atheist is? Of course I know. I'll never tell you what to think or what to believe. I'll just tell you what to do. And in AA, we pray, and it helps us stay sober. So whether you believe or not, you pray. You start praying. He gave us a little 24-hour book and said, read this every day and do it on your knees. And I said, well, God doesn't care, I'm sure. He used to talk like God told him what to tell me. Without any, I tell the guys I sponsor the same thing, by the way. But see, I can justify that because I've taken the third step. And well, clearly what I say is the voice of God. But what happened was, he said, you know, you got to pray on your knees. He said, it doesn't matter, God, but for an arrogant SOB like you, it's really humbling and good for you. So I started doing that stuff, and I felt better. And I tell you, when I was 93 days sober, I was driving from Glendale to Van Nuys along the 134 freeway, and I was going to take my 90-day chip. That was a Tuesday night. The only thing I went to where they gave chips. And I think they give chips down here, don't they? And I know you guys take them from time to time, and you probably don't do what I did. I was rehearsing my chip talk. I was driving along the freeway, and I was rehearsing my chip talk. And, you know, because I realized it was a beautiful day, and it was really sunny. The Santa Anas were blowing in, and I had the windows of the car open, and I was smelling the, you know, right near Forest Lawn Cemetery. It smelled good, and flowers and stuff. And the music was on the radio, and my wife had gone to Al-Anon, and she'd let me get back in the bedroom. And I was going to tell the guys at the meeting, you know, how my life had really turned around in 93 days. And I realized it was true. I wasn't lying, it was really true. My life had turned around. And I started really shaking, and I started crying. I couldn't drive. I was just so emotional, I couldn't drive anymore. I pulled over to the side of the road, and I opened the driver's side, and I walked down the back of the car, and I opened the passenger door, and I wanted to look like I was doing something, I think, and kiss drive-bys or something. And I got down on my knees in the pavement, and put my hands down on the seat, and put my head in my hands, and I thanked God for my sobriety. And that was the beginning of a spiritual journey. You know, it doesn't always work. I don't want you to think that I drove down here today to tell you I'm a spiritual guru and this program always works and God is right here with me and I've brought him to you. But it doesn't work that way for me, you know. Some days, I think this is a cult. And I have some days when I think nobody in AA cares about me. And I have some days when I don't think AA really works and there's no God. I have days of atheism, maybe not days, but maybe periods of it. And what I have to do, what I've learned from my experience in this program is when I feel disconnected, when I feel you don't care about me, because I have to get my butt to a meeting, and I have to raise my hand and tell people how I feel. And then one more time, they'll drag me back into the program. Whether I want to or not, I'll say, look, you're a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, you mean something to other people. How about meaning something for yourself? And then I'll come to a group like this or that other group I spoke at, and I'll share what's going on in my life, things that have hurt me and things that have helped me, and they'll laugh. And that gives me some information. Because, you know, my sponsor told me that I have a search for God on a daily basis, and I may never find him. He said, that probably guys like you will never find him, because if you ever found God, you'd franchise him. He said, what you have to do, though, is just search for him. And my response happens to be wrong. Because when I can tell you these intimate things about myself, and I can see you laughing, and I can see the brightness in your eyes, I hear God's message to me, and it's that he forgives me, and it's about time I forgive myself. You see, I'm real grateful one more time. Because I took the action, because I did what Peggy asked me to do, I'm down here, and I feel wonderful again. And I know what else to do. And I also discovered, if you knew, you want people to like you, that what I really always wanted was not to have people like me. What I really always wanted was to like other people, like myself. And that's the gift you're giving me tonight. You've permitted me to love you. And I'm real grateful for that.